Episode 35, July the 22nd, 2010. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14. Playing golf on the moon is one of the images permanently etched into the memory of humanity's first exploration of the moon. The so-called golf player was Alan Shepard. The guy with him was Dr. Edgar Mitchell, whilst Stuart Roosa orbited the moon in the command module. Today, Ed Mitchell, 2 months away from his 80th birthday, is the only remaining member of Apollo 14 crew. On a recent visit to Pontefract, organized once again by Ken Willoughby, he describes his personal journey to the moon. Amongst other things, he highlights his javelin throw, which by a narrow margin beat the golf ball, as a picture in his presentation illustrates. He spent 9 hours on the surface of the moon during 2 EVAs on February the 5th and 6th, 1971. Apollo 14 was his only spaceflight, and he left NASA in the following year. Ed Mitchell is perhaps best known for his epiphany moment, when on his return journey to Earth, he experienced a unique spiritual sensation which has dominated his professional and personal life ever since. To help understand it, he left NASA to establish the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Over the last few years, he has frequently spoken publicly about his interests in the paranormal, ESP and UFOs. He asserts that the Roswell incident was real, that aliens have landed on the Earth numerous times, and that the US military is responsible for a cover-up. It's strange that someone, a Navy pilot and an Apollo astronaut, with a professional life dominated by leading-edge science and technology, can hold such an unscientific position. He appears oblivious to the contradiction in referring to himself as an astrophysicist and yet accepting that Fred Hoyle's steady-state explanation of cosmology, for which there is very little evidence, to the Big Bang. I wonder how he explains Hubble's law and the expansion of space, the cosmic microwave background radiation, and the relative abundances of primordial elements. I really should have asked him. I did not, in part out of deference. He is one of a unique group of individuals with a special contribution to human history. Who knows, he may well turn out to be right about UFOs. In the meantime, I'll follow the main road of science, signposted with the observational evidence, however long and difficult the journey. Dr. Mitchell was kind enough to share his PowerPoint slides, which I have incorporated into the recording of his hour-long presentation. Links to that presentation and a video version of this recording is available at astrotalkuk.org. You mentioned somebody who came from not far from here, Fred Hoyle. He had a quite interesting a quote that you referred to before.
Yeah, I don't know who he came from. I don't know his part of
not far from here.
Not from here. But I still believe he's correct. I think we live in a continuously creating universe, not just a Big Bang universe.
Oh, I see.
And I think he will be vindicated with that point of view sometime in the next decade or two.
You've been, you're on the surface of the moon for about 9 hours during your trip on Apollo 14. What memories do you have of that 9 hours now?
Well, I can recall any part of it with a little stimulation, because it was all very fresh in my mind, and very significant in my life. And if we we just are starting to walk through it, I think I could tell you almost every step that was made. Some of it was a little mundane, so it didn't stick out. But the setting up all the equipment on the first EVA, and then the climb up Cone Crater, epitomized by the one photograph we've got there. And it being such a tough climb that we ran out of time and water before we could physically go over and look down into Cone Crater, although we were less than 30 feet.
Oh, really?
We were less than 30 feet from the edge. They didn't know that. We didn't quite know that. But they did know we used up all of our consumables and had to turn back. And it was only in retrospect when I backplotted this all the way. We were virtually right on the edge. We could have taken 10 more steps and looked down into the crater itself. Didn't get a chance to do that.
One of the experiences that other astronauts have recalled is that it's very difficult to estimate distances.
Oh, yes. That is was the toughest thing. And we being the first ones to do an exploration on foot, that was a part of this major problem that we were talking about. The rim of Cone Crater was 2 kilometers away, almost 2 kilometers away, and estimating exactly how far the next landmark was, and the geologists wanted us to reach certain very specific landmarks, and finding them and seeing them in what was almost like desert sand dunes turned out to be almost impossible. And so that's why on the later missions, when they had a tracking device, they could tell them exactly how far they were from, like a TACAN in aviation, how far they were from the lunar module. They could navigate far more accurately than we could possibly do that.
Your commander on Apollo 14, Alan Shepard, sadly no longer around, he was also, like you, a Navy pilot. Did you know him before you became an astronaut?
Before he became an astronaut? No, I crossed his path a couple of times, but we didn't know each other.
And do you still meet up with your other colleagues from the NASA space program on a regular basis?
Yes, and we are. Several of us are on the board of the Astronaut Scholarship Fund that gives scholarships to budding students, 20 of them a year. And we meet several times a year in support of the Astronaut Scholarship Fund.
We're in the middle of a global recession right now. NASA has already experienced some budget cuts.
Yes, it was tough.
When do you think we'll go back to the moon?
Well, the moon isn't in the current planning, but it should be, because we need to develop near-Earth space before we, or as we do, distant Earth space. But I think the movement of bringing the entrepreneurial community into spaceflight and exploration is a good move, because I use the example, just after we invented aircraft at the turn of the 20th, beginning of the 20th century, okay, the military started using them right away for warfare, but then the aviation companies immediately formed by the beginning of the 20s, and we had the airline industry, and it took off at that point, and now a major industry in the world. Now, I don't think we can expect to spaceflight to develop quite that quickly, but we already know a number of entrepreneurs. I know one that I worked with, Bob Bigelow, you know that name, who made his money in the hotel business. He wants to have orbiting hotels and going to the moon and coming back as a business. And I know several other entrepreneurs that are developing plans for private space industries, which will help us do what we really need to do, so that governments don't necessarily have to do it. governments have to lead the way and give the permission and set the regulations and the laws such that it's doable. But then it's up to the rest of us to go with it.
And finally, you've been speaking over the last few years about, you're from Roswell, the place in US famous for the alien spacecraft crash. You've seemed to come across further evidence that that really did happen.
I don't have any doubt about it, yes. The evidence is very strong. And it's not just Roswell, but there's a lot more evidence. And I did go to the Pentagon and get this confirmed. So it's not in my mind, it's not even a doubt, not even a question.
Is there any physical evidence you've come across?
Well, I don't have any first-hand contact with aliens. But on the other hand, if you really know the lore, if you really know the people involved, and if you have met and talked with the people who have had contact, very shortly ceased to have doubts. And then you start to look at what we're seeing from the Hubble Space Telescope and seeing the expansiveness that we're now seeing only available since Hubble has been there and allowed us to see so much further into the universe and to see the billions of galactic clusters and galaxies out there, each containing billions of stars. We're just a grain of sand. Our whole solar system is just a grain of sand in the larger scheme of things. And that is a new set of ideas for humankind to have to get their head around in our time frame. And since we're not on a sustainable path, we've got to get our head around all of this very quickly before we do ourselves in.
You're optimistic for the future, then?
I am optimistic if we confront and deal with the problem. But at the moment, certainly in my country, there's a lot of resistance to confronting and dealing with the fact. I won't use the word global warming, I'll use the word climate change and sustainability, and that we're destroying our resources at an alarming rate. Overpopulating. Now we're starting to bring the population down a little bit, but overpopulating. And water resources are getting scarce. There's a whole host of natural resources that unless we start to harbor them and husband them in a different way, we're going to do us in.
And do you ever look at the moon through a telescope these days?
Well, I don't have, these days I don't have a telescope immediately in my home. I used to, but I don't today, but I look at it a lot anyhow.
Well, you used to, so earlier on when you were younger?
Well, when I was younger, when I was a student, I made my own telescope.
Oh, okay.
For the fun of it.
Right. So really you started off as an amateur astronomer. In some ways,
yeah. Well, I'm a student of astronomy, a cosmologist, and enjoy asking the deep questions about, okay, what's this really all about?
Well, it's very heartening to see that you take time out to talk to youngsters and share your experiences in this way.
Well, we have to, it's all a part of changing this whole picture of non-sustainability. We have spent almost the entire 20th century coming to grips with the fact that Descartes was wrong in his duality, that body-mind don't interact. And they do interact, and we can validate that in the laboratory and have over and over and over again. And so building on that and recognizing that we have a direct and profound effect on the way nature is organized and the things that happen in nature is something we have to confront, and that's our responsibility to do that.
Going back to Fred Hoyle and steady state, if it is a steady state, what's sustaining the universe, do you think?
Well, it's not sustaining. It is continuously creating matter, and star systems have a life cycle, burn out, turn into black holes, and then slowly radiate away. but the underlying zero-point field, that is, by current theory, presumably the source of the Big Bang, is continuously creating matter. And we now, and even though many cosmologists and astronomers haven't really got on the bandwagon with this, the fact that we have the mathematics called Heisenberg nilpotent Lie group algebra that shows how out of the quantum fluctuations of the zero-point field that matter can continuously generate itself out of the zero-point field.
Oh, I see. So it is continuously evolving within a scientific context.
Yes.
And the second law of thermodynamics is maintained.
Well, because it appears to be an infinite source of energy, but that does not on the Big Bang, one has to ask the question, what caused the Big Bang? Mm. And it's much more reasonable if we now have a mathematical out of good quantum physics showing how the quantum fluctuations in the zero-point field can result, and I believe that's the source of dark energy and dark matter, frankly.
You are a cosmologist indeed. Coming to dark energy and dark matter, which is an issue that's...
Well, I think that is exactly the evidence that will eventually be accepted. That is the proof of what Hoyle was talking about, that it's continuously being created. And now, this could maybe be another decade or so before that idea solidifies, but to me, it's a viable idea.
Today's quote is from someone else who made a huge contribution on how we should go about understanding the cosmos, Carl Sagan. I believe that the extraordinary should be pursued, but extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.